1280 WAUK Jackson, Milwaukee's real news and great conversation. A Civic Media Station.
CBS News Brief. In Israel, many gathered in Tel Aviv to mourn four dead hostages released by Gaza after 15 months. But Israel's military says one of the bodies is not a hostage, and they don't know who it is. That would be a violation of a ceasefire agreement between Israel and Hamas. National Security Advisor Mike Waltz says President Trump wants to see the Russia-Ukraine war end because of how brutal it has been on both sides.
There has been ongoing fighting on both sides. It is World War I style trench warfare.
President Trump marked Black History Month at the White House by announcing that he's bringing Alice Johnson, a prison reform advocate whom he pardoned in 2020, into his administration to work on clemency issues.
You've been an inspiration to people. And we're going to be listening to your recommendation on pardons.
He found out about Johnson's case from Kim Kardashian. CBS News Brief. I'm Matt Piper.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
Bobby Portis suspended 25 games. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Bucks' Bobby Portis suspended for the next 25 games by the NBA. After testing positive for a non-approved painkiller, Portis says he thought he was taking Toradol for an elbow injury. Instead, an assistant of his gave him a prescription of Tramadol, a painkiller banned by the league last spring. Bucks head coach Doc Rivers.
I just feel bad for Bobby on so many levels. You know, dude's gone through a lot, you know, this year with his mom passing and, you know, his house been broken in and then this, you know. You know, the thing I did tell him is this is going to be one hell of a story for you. You know, our goals haven't changed as a team. This is going to be harder. I mean, Bobby's a huge loss. I'm not going to try to sugarcoat that. He's been so good for us. Not only on the floor, but his spirit. Like, we need his spirit.
The Bucks hosting the Clippers. A recap coming up later tonight with sports. I'm Mike Clemens.
Earl Ingram.
Mayor Johnson, we used to have a saying called the switcheroo. Talking about one thing while behind the scenes, there's a greater issue.
This man was elected president of the United States to focus in on making everyday life more affordable. But our push to remove lead service lines, our health department, are impacted by the things that the Trump administration have targeted since they've been in office. Yeah, it's been a huge switcheroo. It's not been about saving folks money. I mean, this is going to cause more pain.
The Earl Ingram Show, weekday mornings 8 to 10 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. A new choice, Milwaukee's real news and great conversation, 540 WAUK.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to. Oh, the bromance. Oh, it was the threesome was just it was a beautiful thing to watch. As our royal elite as Musk and Trump, we got to watch their courtship front and center with Sean Hannity rounding out the threesome. Oh, it was a love fest. One tripping over the other to compliment the other. It was wonderful. And look, you know, along partisan lines, you had the right who just lapped it up. They look at how strong and how virile and. You got all that, and on the left, you know, this is, it's farcical, it's ridiculous, it's, you know, it's no good, yeah, it's all bad, and you got me looking at it going, really? The political theater part of this, the constantly in your eyeball, that's what bothered me. I could care less what they say and how they fawn over each other. Could care less. It's what they're doing that is destructive. And while we're treating them on the right like it's Prince Charles and Diane all over again, I'm waiting for the coronation. I'm waiting for I'm waiting for the ball, the debutante ball. When will we see, and who will wear the dress? as we're going after the LGBTQ community. It seems weird. Seems weird to me, America. But, you know, our little dictator and our authoritarian prince, they understand what they're doing. And they're out there constantly in what is their show. This is a reality TV show. And he's always been the reality TV president. He understands that as long as he's in your ear, he's on your mind, he's winning. And he's going to do whatever they want to do anyway. Look, you know, it's my view, you're not going to stop them from doing the nasty things that they're going to do and that they are doing. But this is also part of the political theater. There's the actions that they're taking that we're not spending enough time focused on while they're dancing around, driving around in the Beast around Daytona, getting people who aren't even race fans upset. That, look at what they're doing. Yeah, if you want to be upset about it, think of the money that they spent to get there. If you want to be upset about something, think about the money that Trump wasted going to the Super Bowl or the $11 million he spent playing golf. Think about all of the, while we have a Department of Government Efficiency, while we're literally firing people just because, well, I don't know why, we're going to save money. We've got a president, an authoritarian, and his prince running around like drunken sailors, spending our tax dollars. But when it comes to you or me, and it comes to the organizations that make up our government, we're going to squeeze the quarter until the eagle screams. And what I find interesting is you're starting to see some cracks. Republican governors like Kevin Stitt in Oklahoma is going, hey, you know, I know you got a real problem with that Inflation Reduction Act thing, and I know, you know, you're hell bent on the drill baby drill, and look, we are too, Oklahoma, a lot of drill baby drill, but you know, maybe don't pick winners and losers on energy sources, because you know we got some wind, we do that wind thing here. So, you know, some of that money that we were expecting from Biden, you know, some of that evil, no good spending, but some of that we were expecting to come to us. We were going to use in our welfare states to be able to make our corporations more profitable. We were going to feed the wealthy. Now, never mind those poor people. Never mind those teachers who, you know, one of the lowest paid in the state. No, we want to make sure that you know, the money that was going to go from the Inflation Reduction Act to our, you know, our wind people and to our alternative energy folks. Yeah, we want that. You know, take it from the other people. And this is the interesting part, because you've got some red state governors now going, and some red state senators going, We's got some constituents back home, and they need stuff. They've got expectations. Now you could go gut all that, you know, from New York and California, sure, but don't take it from us. We need government welfare. We need that additional money we steal from Massachusetts and New Jersey and New York and California. We need that redistribution of wealth. Shh, don't tell anyone, but we do. And it's interesting to start to see that, because you've got senators in the last several days who have gone to some of these cabinet secretaries and say, you know, maybe let some of that cash go. And the hypocrisy is what kind of has me. Because again, these are the people who, you know, we want to shrink the size of government, of course, and we're going to return. Evidently, there's a return policy that they're kicking around, and more checks. It's amazing. The anti-welfare people are good at giving themselves welfare. But it's amazing watching these folks play this dance for their base to say, oh, we're just auditing, we're about good governance, while everything they're doing is about destroying it. Now, as I've said before, I do believe there are ways that we should be reacting. I've said in the past, I think we're going to have to go through a period like our grandparents' generation or my grandparents' generation, where you're in the streets. And, you know, things happen in the streets. I don't advocate violence or destruction or any of that stuff. But unfortunately, the only time that the elites listen is when the pitchforks are about to come out. When they start seeing working people sharpening their pitchforks, and not while wearing red hats or blue hats, that's when they start caring. When they can no longer divide us, and this is an opportunity. And I've had a lot of conversations with red hat folk who they're not thrilled with the direction that the Musk and Trump bromance are taking them. They really thought it was just going to be going after brown people, sending them back and cheapening eggs. They didn't realize it was going to be a total destruction of the norms and values of the country. No, didn't think that, and didn't think it was going to be them. So there's going to be an opportunity for us to find each other. And that's a good thing. As I said on the day after the election, when chaos happens is when we unite. When bad things happen, that's what brings us together. It's what's lying around, to quote the sainted right-wing pundit and economist Milton Friedman. Uncle Milty was clear. It's the ideas that are lying around when there's crisis, either real or perceived, that get put into place. We need to be pushing for those ideas. And when we come back, Joseph McCartan's going to be here, professor of history at Georgetown University, to share some thoughts on, well, maybe how we get there. Quick break, right back.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, you know, as I've been saying, look, the reality is you're not going to stop the steamroller from running over us, but there's an organizing opportunity here. And as I've said, it's the ideas that we dream up. It's the things that we wanted. Out of their savagery, out of the suffering that comes from their savagery, will come the solutions of how we reclaim and make this country a little bit better. And I've had a lot of people going, well, what does that mean? I go, well, there's some great opportunities to get involved, to get active, and to organize around some good ideas. And on Thursday, February 27th at 7 p.m., the folks at LACHA are holding a panel on working people organizing against authoritarianism, past and present perspectives. And the moderator, the guy who the chief cook and bottle washer there, is my next guest. Joseph McCartan is a professor of history at Georgetown University, executive director of the Kamanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor, and of course, president of LACHA, the Labor and Working Class History Association. Joseph, thanks for taking time for us.
Great to see you, Rick.
So, look, I've gotten a lot of people going, well, what do we do? You know, Rick, you paint this hopeless picture of we're not going to stop them. What do we do? And I say, look, we slow them where we can, but it's about organizing for the future. It's about what we're going to do in the future. And I think, you know, this panel, this idea of organizing against what they're doing is kind of a start, right?
I think so, Rick. And I think history can give us a lot of pointers and lessons about how to deal with the kind of moment we're in. It's not the first time that working people in this country have seen this kind of all-out onslaught of people who want to destroy the labor movement, of people who want to weaken worker bargaining power, of people who want to divide the country in various ways, along lines of color, for example, in between immigrants and natives. We've been there before. And you're right, it's really hard when a moment like this emerges to stop it full on. But we can maybe, you know, lessen some of the damage now. But more importantly, as you were just saying, lay the basis for rolling this back, maybe not in the next month or two, but as the devastating consequences of what is currently happening in this country begin to sink in, it absolutely will create organizing opportunities. And we have to be ready to seize those. History can help us with that.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I have people go, well, you don't seem all that distressed. And I go, no, I'm not distressed. I'm motivated because, look, history does tell us we've been in these kind of scenarios before. We've been in crisis before. There have been problems. There have been depressions. There have been civil wars. There have been we had the robber baron era where they controlled literally everything. I do believe in the spirit of the American people. I believe in the spirit of the Constitution and all of that stuff. It's just sometimes we've got to relearn a little bit. As I say about labor, you got to relearn the concept of solidarity. And I think we're moving towards that relearning phase.
I think that's right, Rick. I think one thing about our culture and our society is it tends to have a kind of built-in amnesia. And this is especially true, I think, for the history of workers and their movement. Not many working people know about the history of the movement, where the weekend came from, where the eight-hour day for the time when it prevailed, where that came from, where union rights came from. Because we don't know a lot of that story, because we're never taught it, it doesn't exist for us as a resource we can draw on to, you know, help and guide us in moments like the one we're now in. But it's always possible to pick up on that. Events right now are making a lot of people think back to, like, well, has anything like this happened before? And the fact is, yes. You alluded a moment ago to the Gilded Age of the robber barons. And some of the same things that we're seeing going on now did happen then. There were figures like Elon Musk who basically controlled our government. They were not named Musk then. They were named Rockefeller and Carnegie and folks like that. Back then, there was a tremendous anti-immigrant feeling stirred in the country. That was happening then. It's happening now. Workers were divided then, and in some cases duped by the reigning political figures of their time to believe that that these people were really going to deliver a better life for them. Donald Trump likes to talk lately a lot about one of the leading political figures of that long ago era, William McKinley. McKinley loved tariffs like Trump did. Yeah. McKinley promised, like Trump promises, tariffs will solve all your problems, workers. It took workers having to actually live through that period to learn that actually they didn't help at all. And this is not necessarily the best way to go. So, you know, we're being directed back to learn from periods like that about what is going on now. And I think that that can be helpful to us as we, as you say, get ready for what is to come.
Yeah, we had to live, you know, I saw a really great meme on social media that I agree with. You know, we had to live through the McKinleys, the Hoovers. We had to live through that to get to the FDR. Look, we had to live through the horrible. We had to be exploited and desperate and usable before we said, hey, we've got enough. And I said, look, you know, I've been saying this constantly. I'm sure people are tired of it. But I do believe the solutions will come out of the suffering due to their savagery. The things that they are going to do and the things that they've done are going to make people very uncomfortable, are going to make people suffer. And out of that, I do believe, and I got to believe, that we're going to come back together and reunite in a direction that makes my children and my grandchildren's lives better.
I absolutely agree with that, Rick. And, you know, sadly, pain is one of the great teachers. I mean, when you're a little kid, you get close to the hot stove and you touch it, you remember, okay, that's not good. But you don't know until you've gotten that pain inflicted that that's the thing to be feared. And right now, I think we're in a period where people have not really seen the kind of thing that's currently happening. Sadly, so many of our voters, the people who put this current party in power, you know, didn't realize the pain that would be inflicted.
I disagree with you on that. I think they knew pain would be inflicted. I just didn't think they knew it was going to be them.
Well, that's what I mean. That's what I mean. They were, sadly, you know, many of them ready to inflict pain on others and to try to demonize others for what is currently going wrong with our system. And we have a systemic problem here. It's not a problem that immigrants created for us. They're here as one of the symptoms of the way the system isn't working. And that's the thing people need to address. But you're right. Some people were like, yeah, those people deserve it and whatever. And
some people just wanted cheap eggs. I just wanted cheap eggs.
That's right.
Which brings me back to what you guys are doing on February 27th. That's a Thursday. Right. You can register at Alacha Feb Panel, right? Is that where it's at?
That's right. It's bit.ly/Lawcha, LawchaFebPanel. That's right. Lawcha Feb Panel.
We'll work on getting things easier to get to. But going back to this idea of organizing against authoritarianism, you know, it's one of those things of understanding that you got a problem first before you can then solve that problem. Walk me through some of what you're hoping the panel is going to discuss and what you think people should know.
Well, first, we're going to bring together some of the smartest people I know. People have thought about these kind of things through their work as historians for a long time. Will Jones of the University of Minnesota has written a lot about the civil rights movement and its era, black workers and their role in the labor movement. Felicia Kornbluh of University of Vermont, who's worked a lot on the history of reproductive rights. Nancy McLean, who many of your listeners and viewers will know, who wrote the wonderful book called Democracy in Chains, about the whole movement really that began in the 50s that has culminated, you might say, in this recent sort of government takeover we're witnessing. And Paul Ortiz, who's now at Cornell, he's been a leading activist and writer about labor, Latino, and Black history. And so these are folks who've thought about this stuff. They've looked at past events in ways that people have resisted authoritarianism in the U.S. And what we can learn from that. One thing that I would say is, you know, people talk about, are we witnessing a kind of fascism here? Is that what's happening? And I would say we don't have to look to Europe to be able to understand what's happening here. We saw something like this before in our history. It's what happened in the late 19th century. It was the creation of the Jim Crow South, where democracy was squelched, where people were divided by race, where the ruling class ruled in ways that benefited itself. So a lot of what we're seeing is a kind of reconstitution of that earlier vision. And these folks understand all of that. They can talk about what happened then, how workers resisted some of that stuff, and also about what's going on right now. And there's, I think, a lot to be excited about, Rick, because I think some organizing is already beginning that's laying the groundwork for what you're talking about in the long run.
No, this is, you know, right after Election Day, I said, look, this is where we're heading. You know, it's, you know, it doesn't take a genius to figure out, you know, where we're going. You just have to remember a little bit of history. And, you know, I have a friend who's an economics professor who said, you know, can you name me, you know, the robber barons? Can you name some of the robber barons, the billionaires of that era? And of course, you ticked a couple of them off, the Carnegies, the Rockefellers, the Vanderbilts. You know, you can go down a list because you know who they are. The Jay Goulds of the world. I can pay half the working class to murder the other half.
That's right.
He goes, but go to the 1950s and 60s. Do you know who the billionaires of that period were? And you might be able to hunt, and you can throw out a rich guy's name, but they weren't as prevalent. They weren't as out front. They weren't as flashy because we had good policy that kind of reined them in. So yeah, now we've got the Musks and the Bezoses and the Gates. You can list the 1,800 billionaires we've got. Policy created them.
Yes. Policy created them, and you're so right about that. Just take Elon Musk for an example. I mean, this guy's businesses have relied upon massive federal contracts over the years. You know, Tesla really got off the ground because of help it got from the Obama administration.
Yep.
But a lot of these folks like to think that they've done it all on their own. Jeff Bezos wouldn't have his business if not for the massive taxpayer-funded innovations that created the internet that Amazon operates on. So, you know, we've had the emergence of this billionaire class, Rick. And you're right, it's a very different group from the ruling class, you might say, of the 1950s. Because these people who were all basically born on third base because of what the taxpayer laid out for them, they believe that they've created it all. And they believe that they, you know the best for everybody. Can you imagine somebody in the 50s thinking the way Elon Musk does now, that I know so much about everything that I'm just going to go in and decide what agencies live, what agencies die, who gets fired? I mean, you know, billionaires, the very wealthy then had a degree of modesty. You know why? They lived through the Great Depression. They lived through the rise of the labor movement, and they also were somewhat worried about stepping out in that way because they knew there were people ready to push back.
There were people with pitchforks. And, yeah. You know, this is why it's always been curious to me that the Bezoses and the Musks aren't much more philanthropic. Because, look, with the kind of wealth that they have, they could build legacy. They could, and, you know, childhood poverty, they could, and veteran homelessness, they could, with the kind of wealth and initiative, if we're going to run this country like a business, they could easily solve our problems. They choose not to, because just as you said, they know better.
Yeah. I mean, that's something they believe for sure. And there are some that are better than others. I think Bill Gates uses his foundation to some extent in good things. I don't always agree with what he's done, but these other folks don't even make a pretense of being out there for the public good, building a legacy. At least Carnegie built public libraries for people. He broke unions, he broke strikes, but he did leave a little something. Jeff Bezos, I would say it's the exact opposite. He's taken an institution in the Washington Post that used to sort of do good journalism, and he's breaking it even as we speak.
Yeah, but you brought up Carnegie breaking unions. That seems to be the fascination, the purview of the billionaire class, you know, to ensure that the poor and the downtrodden never organize against them, because you've got the Bezoses and the Musks right now as we speak, you know, trying to have the NLRA ruled unconstitutional. There's all of these assaults on organized labor in the on the federal workforce, because we're seeing all these firings. So I guess last line of questioning I've got, as we're, you know, organizing against authoritarianism, isn't this really a worker uprising, or shouldn't it be?
It should be. It should be. Right now, I think a lot of workers are still on the sidelines. As you say, they're waiting for the price of eggs to come down. They don't necessarily see yet or have felt yet some of the pain that's going to flow from what's currently happening. But workers do need to be in the midst of this. I would argue that really it depends on workers. It depends on workers coming to understand that what is currently happening is not in their interest and beginning to organize for something better. And as you were saying earlier, I think sometimes you have to live through some pain to be able to be motivated for that. Most workers today, as you know, Rick, and your listeners well know, I mean, are just trying to get by.
Yep.
They're working really hard to do that, and like they don't have time to engage in all of the kind of stuff that, you know, in a time of crisis, sometimes you need to do. Organizing, for example.
No, look, and the only time in the history of this country that we really unite is around crisis. And I fear one is coming. And, you know, I always go back to the old labor frame of, you know, when your stomach's empty, your head gets right. You know, maybe that's what it's going to take. But Joseph, I appreciate the time. I wish you guys the best on the panel. February 27th, 7 p.m. bit.ly/LachaPanel. We're gonna do better
Lacha
on this.
Feb panel. Lacha Feb panel.
There you go. We'll get links how to.
Or you can go. People can go to our easier to find website, just Lacha.org.
There you go. Better yet. Joseph McCartan, okay. I appreciate you taking time for us.
Thank you, Rick.
I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Is this something we should be gathering around? Are you ready to get out in the streets? You got those comfortable shoes that Obama never used? Better find them. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Right back.
A voice for real news and great conversation in Milwaukee, 540 WAUK.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. A clearing sky for tonight, a low of 5 to 10, wind chills below zero. Mostly sunny for tomorrow, the warming trend finally kicks in. A high in the mid-20s. To the upper 20s Saturday, mid-30s Sunday, partly sunny. It's 14 degrees right now.
It might be cold outside, but we're back on the road to find out what makes Wisconsin great, including the American Burr Combiner.
Road trip!
It's the best ski race in the world. I'm Todd Alba. I'm taking you to the Burr Combiner and what it means for the state.
Normally, we're about 2,600 people during Berkey Week. That gets up to 20, 30,000.
Join us from Hayward, Wisconsin.
A special Todd Alba show Thursday and Friday.
At noon on your local Civic Media radio station and the app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So it's been really interesting watching Elon Musk and Donald Trump with their little bromance going and doing interviews and talking about, you know, I actually saw rebate checks. This is how they're going to sell the destruction of your government. This is how they're going to sell you dirty air and dirty water. And this is how they're going to repeal the 20th century. They're going to give you a little token. Here's a couple of dollars. Now, remember, they told you we're going to save, you know, what was the number? Like $700 million by destroying this one agency. Works out to like $2.50 a person. So are you willing to give up control of who and where we are for a handful of pennies? I sure hope not, because I got to tell you, it's looking real, real bad. And here to share some thoughts on just how bad it is from the inside, I've asked Maria Owens Powell to come share some thoughts with us. She's council president for AFGE, Council 238. They deal with the EPA. You know, the people who make sure we have clean air and clean water. You know, those folks. Maria, thanks for taking time for us.
Hi, Rick. Thank you so much for having me.
So look, I'm a kid who grew up in the 70s in Cleveland. I argue Cleveland was the home of the Clean Water and Clean Air Act. As a kid, suffered horribly from asthma. You couldn't go in Lake Erie. It was a lot of bad. And it was because a Republican president said, hey, we should probably, you know, have clean air and water, that you guys exist. And now you've got, well, all out assaults on government across the board, including our Environmental Protection Agency.
Absolutely. Isn't that the irony of it, that it's now a Republican administration that is seeking to disband the entire agency? As you said, I mean, in the 70s, Cleveland wasn't alone. There was widespread, you know, water pollution, air pollution, folks with asthma problems being exacerbated. We've come a long way since then. And every one of these current actions that are being taken against the employees of the EPA is just setting us up to roll all the way back to the 70s, if not even worse.
Yeah, I'm feeling old, to be honest with you, because the 70s seemed like a long time ago, but we had acid rain, we had smog, we had, as a kid, had to watch the evening news to see, hey, will I be able to go outside and play tomorrow, because the pollution index was through the roof. And we, through good policy, We fix that. My fear through greed and bad policy and, well, destruction of government, my children, my grandchildren may inherit the same kind of environment I grew up in.
Oh, I think that's a very real fear. I mean, as civil servants at the EPA, we have one mission. It's protecting human health and the environment. It has nothing to do with politics, Republican, Democrat. It doesn't. It just means that we fight against this unprecedented climate emergency that we're seeing right now and ensure every American has clean air and drinking water.
Yeah, it's one of those things I think we've taken, I know I've taken for granted, you know, and I think my kids have as well, but this is kind of, help me here, because there's part of me that goes, maybe this assault can be turned into something positive, to where we start talking about, hey, do we really want to be a place where we have to collect rainwater to get clean water because the groundwater is so badly polluted, and even that we can't trust? Maybe this gets us to rethink the great work that you guys do and maybe solidify it a little more.
We often say at EPA, because I also work for the EPA, not for AFGE, and we always say that when you can turn on your water and cook dinner, when you can go for a jog and breathe, that means we're doing a good job. So it is catch 22. It's when the American public doesn't think about us, that's when it's proof that we are doing our job. So it is a difficult thing to help people understand, but do we really want to roll back, number one?
No.
And
no,
number two, natural disasters are continuing. We have folks that are out at the LA fire cleanup, but since then we've also had flooding in Kentucky. Who knows what they're going to need, right? And on top of that, we have accidents and emergencies. Right up by Philly, there's a fire where folks are, you know, confined to their home. Who am I sending there if you get rid of our agency?
People just have to figure it out for themselves. This is freedom, Marie. This is freedom, liberty.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like.
You're on your own, brother, is the kind of freedom and liberty they're selling us. And I gotta be honest. The more that they continue to do this, because the joke I made the other day is, you know, sadly, I think they're going to have egg on their face if they can afford the eggs, because all of these cuts. And look at the thing with the nuclear stockpile. They went and fired a bunch of people. Then they go, oh, gee, we actually need those people. Couldn't mm-hmm. find them to bring them back. And I find that to be that kind of incompetence all across the board, because these people don't believe in the work that you do. They don't believe you should do the work that you do. And they're arrogant enough to believe that, you know, some invisible hand is going to take care of it.
Rick, you know, I think it's even worse than that. I think they just don't care. So on Friday, the agency fired 388 probationary employees. The agency's refusing to give me a list of those people that were fired. And then when I found out why, it makes it even worse. It's because yesterday they were calling some of those 388 people to say, oops, we didn't mean it. You're unfired.
How can you
so
unfire
someone? Those
poor
people had a long weekend, right? President's weekend, fretting about the loss of their livelihood. And for a handful of them, it was, oopsie, never mind. They just don't care.
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it. But I think the incompetence is even bigger. Mm-hmm. I think the fact that they're not curious, they don't care. And where they do care, it's in their interest to destroy any regulation. Because ultimately, for me, it's always about follow the money. And the money is, if we can destroy regulations, you know, job mm-hmm. killers, you know, Marie, job killing regulation. If we could destroy those, there's more profit to be made.
Yeah, and I think they act and then they think after. For example, they sent a bunch of people who worked in environmental justice home on administrative leave. Well, I know of at least one of them who was out doing LA fire cleanup. Well, the minute they put them on administrative leave, they lose access to all EPA systems. That individual was stranded out there in California because he couldn't get onto the system. Jeez. To book airfare to get home. Like, EPA had to step in and say, I'm sorry, AFG had to step in and say, hey, EPA, you need to on administrative leave this person to at least get them home.
at the minimum. But, you know, this is... So let me ask you this, because one of the frames I heard a lot during the campaign is, you know, we just want to run government like a business. I'm sure you've heard this 1,000 times. We just want it to run like a business. We want, you know, strict controls. We want people back in the office. We want these certain business things. One, do you think this is what being run like a business looks like? And if you do think this is what a business looks like, you know, is this what we want?
So, God, I hope this is not what running a business looks like. The way I've heard that before, and the way I think about it is, you wouldn't take someone who had a successful business as, say, running a nail salon to run, you know, a chemical company. That's exactly what the similarities here. These are people who have never worked in government, who don't understand how government works, doesn't understand the checks and balances, not only that we have, but why we have them. I am not saying that there are not improvements needed, probably across the government. This just is not the way we do it.
Yeah, no, there's always...
I don't know.
There's always a way to improve. There's always something we want to make better, and we should be striving to do that. And for those people go, you just don't want to audit government. No, I do. In fact, we have auditors who do this. These aren't auditors. These are coders. So it's telling me that they're not really interested in auditing. They're interested in getting their tentacles into every branch of our government and ferreting as deep and as far into our information systems as possible. It's not about good governance. It's not about efficiency. It's not about any of that. It's about pure gold mining greed. And that's, for me, that's the bottom line in this.
I agree, and I think it's very much they're interested in shock and awe. They want to show their power. When they send home, and with the intent of eventually dismissing our environmental justice folks, included in that roundup were secretaries. Those people don't do anything but process time cards and travel requests. They don't do environmental justice work specific. They just support the group. That it made no sense whatsoever. And the response we got back from the agency was, well, they're in that organization. This is what they want. They want the big splash, the shock and awe. Mm-hmm. They want to show the American people we're in charge.
No, I mean, we're going to make the federal government. And you're going to be able to enjoy what the private sector gets, which is at-will employment and desperation. And they want to know. They want you to know who's the boss. Which is weird, but and not a way to run a lemonade stand, let alone the most powerful government on the planet. But here we are. So in this moment, Marie, you know, this to me is an opportunity for we as the public to really support the people who were fired. I mean, I look at how the right rallied around all of the criminals who broke into our Capitol and destroyed, you know, and defecated on the floor of our Capitol on January 6th, how they rallied around them. Is this not an opportunity for us to rally around the people who have been fired and say, hey, you know, these people are victims and these people should be made whole and raise them up in a way that makes them feel empowered and all workers feel empowered?
Absolutely. And I know AFG Council 238, we're still exploring the administrative and legal options, but we've had a swell of support of different organizations reaching out to us, past EPA leadership. Management reaching out to us from both sides of the aisle saying, hey, this isn't right. This isn't the way it's supposed to work. It's just been so difficult because every day they're throwing something new at us. Fork in the road, probationary employees, DEI, hiring freeze, return to office. You know, as recent as yesterday, there was a new executive order or a presidential memo about ensuring accountability for agencies. And it specifically says, the president and the AG, subject to the president's supervision, have authoritative interpretation of laws.
So it means they can do whatever they want to whomever they want, however they want. Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly what it sounds like to me.
So that means he can just walk down.
And coming from a science agency, that's when we progress. When there is robust debate over what the data says and what the data means. This is just seeking to just stop everything in its tracks.
So what you're telling me is when King Donald and Prince Elon, when they come walking through your agency, everyone cowers in fear, not because they're not doing their job, not because they don't know what they're doing, but because they might offend someone by looking weird or having a different thought. Is that what you're telling
Absolutely.
Me?
Absolutely. That's exactly what it sounds like to me.
Now, again, I said all during the campaign that, you know, Project 2025 was all about making patronage great again. It was all about, you know, giving an authoritarian-leaning government the ability to, well, create their own realities. I think I was right.
Oh, absolutely. And Project 2025, it wasn't a plan. It was a checklist, and they are accomplishing everything on there. They are literally going bullet by bullet, at least as it applies to my agency, the EPA. They are good. So we know where they're going next. The expectation is that the folks that are on administrative leave, they're going to move to do a reduction in force with them. The enforcement division likely going to go, as you said earlier, who wants to fine people that are polluting as long as they're making big money. So it's just horrible.
When they accomplish their mission, and look, they have been very clear for decades that they want to deregulate, they want to slash and burn, because job killers, Marie, you're a job killer, you are.
Yep.
When they finally accomplish their goal, which is to destroy your agency and neuter it, what does that mean for the average, you know, truck driver? What does that mean for the average, you know, person who's working at a grocery store, mom taking the kids to the park?
Sure.
How does that filter down to me and my neighbors and my kids? What does that look like?
So what that means is if you are a person who lives in an underrepresented community, the pollution is not just going to continue, it is going to increase because there's no cop on the duty there. Okay, so your children who suffer from asthma will suffer more. It also means if we have a train derailment like in East Palestine, you're on your own. You may, I don't know if the administration wants you to use a bucket and a mop, but that toxic spill is not going to be cleaned up if the EPA no longer exists. If there are wildfires, hurricanes, unprecedented flooding, the response to clean up those type of natural disasters, the individuals for that will not be here. They're not going to be on duty. They're not going to be around to do it.
You make an interesting point, because if you remember when President Trump went to Los Angeles and they had that meeting, they had that little PR stunt, whatever they were doing with the mayor. And the mayor's like, well, when can people get back in their homes? And the mayor's like, you know, a week or so, we just want to make sure everything's safe. And Trump's like, no, let them go right back in there now. Get them in there with mops and buckets. I think you've already hit on
irresponsible. How irresponsible. Everybody's home is full of household hazardous waste. What happens when those chemicals ignite? You have hazardous chemicals. It's not rocket science. So you need to handle it appropriately. You don't send people in with a feather duster and say, go ahead, you're fine, go home. That's just not what you do.
But freedom. But freedom, Marie. Freedom.
I understand freedom, but I also appreciate safety, and I appreciate guidance given from those individuals who have committed their life to protection of human health and the environment, and on what their opinions is of when it is safe for me and my family to re-enter.
Yeah, I mean, we used to, you know, this is the scary part for me, and, you know, all seriousness, the part that's frightening to me is how we've belittled expertise and knowledge and people who have spent a lifetime, you know, researching and studying and understanding things, how we've belittled that. And now we're in this weird spot. Where it's just all about the gotcha. It's all about the social media memes or the, you know, I went viral. We're in a weird spot.
Yeah, and I echo how scary it is. The employees at the EPA, most of them are there not because it's a job, not for the glamour, but they're truly dedicated. They're true environmentalists that are truly dedicated to ensuring not only our children, but our children's children have a habitable planet.
Now, what's interesting, if I could stop you there, I know my red hats, what they heard you just say is you're a bunch of tree huggers. You just want us standing around doing nothing.
Oh, gosh, absolutely not. These people want to have successful lives as well. They just have chosen to go into federal service to help make the world a little bit of a better place. They're not... No, it's not a bunch of folks hugging a tree and saying, let's not do anything, let's not progress. What we're saying is, let's progress, but let's do it in the safest way possible, not only for ourselves, but for our future generations.
Absolutely. And look, you know, where I started this, I remember my childhood. I remember, you know, sucking the fumes out of the leaded gasoline that was choking us at every opportunity. The indexes, the smog, the horrible, the fish in Lake Erie floating sideways with one eye looking up at the sky because they're all dead. I don't want that for my children and my grandchildren. So we can and we must and we have to do better if we're going to leave them something worth inheriting. But Marie, I appreciate you taking time for us. Keep up the fight. Last question. What do we do in this moment? Is there a marching order? Is there hope? Is there something that you're going, I said yesterday, I had someone on yesterday, I go, you know, what's the marching order? Should we take a picture of the trees? Should we take a picture of the clean water? Because we're going to, maybe that's the only way we'll remember it. What's the marching order?
I think number one is there's always room for hope. But I think the action, because we need to take action. The action is every single day, call your representatives, especially those on the other side of the aisle. Call and tell them what you want. I don't care if we blow up the phone system by all these phone calls. I also challenge every single person that hears this to reach out to 5 family members or 5 friends and challenge them to also call representatives every single day. They have to hear us.
Yeah. No, this is an organizing opportunity. It is as labor unions, as representatives, it's incumbent on you guys. You're the last line of defense, which is why you're number one on their hit list. If we're going to save this thing, it's going to be you folks. But Marie, I appreciate you taking time for us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Marie Owens Powell, she's council president of AFGE, Council 238, the EPA folks, the people who give you the clean water and air, the cops on the beat. Tell me what you think. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Do we need it? Can we just buy bottled water, right? Nestle will sell it to us. You do understand most of that's tap water. Yeah. Quick break, right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. This day in labor history, the year was 1937. That was the day the National Lawyers Guild held their first convention in the nation's capital. The guild was established as a way to bring together progressive lawyers dedicated to fighting for basic and progressive change in our political and economic system and to assure that human rights be regarded as more sacred than property interests. Members were admitted regardless of race, sex, or political beliefs. The early guild stood up for FDR's New Deal reforms like a full Social Security program against the staunch opposition of the American Bar Association. From its inception, protecting the rights of working people has been an important effort for the guild. At the first convention, they passed a resolution supporting the rights of working people to organize and collectively bargain. Guild lawyers supported the founding of both the United Auto Workers and the Congress of Industrial Organizations. They also stood up for civil rights, adopting an anti-lynching resolution at their first convention. During the civil rights era, they provided legal aid for activists and fought for voting rights. This made them a target during the 1950s Cold War anti-communist hysteria. The FBI targeted the Guild for investigation. By 1955, the Guild had dropped to just 500 members. In the 1970s, the Guild successfully sued to find out the extent of FBI spying. They discovered that 1,000 informants had generated FBI files of 400,000 pages on the Guild and its members. Despite this harassment, the Guild has kept up its fight for working people. The organization has opposed anti-worker legislation from Taft-Hartley to the passage of NAFTA. In 2012, the Guild celebrated its 75th anniversary stronger than ever.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So, you know, look, anybody who remembers the 70s, and I do, remembers, it was not a great time. Pollution was bad. Things were not great. And it was one of those, I had taken my son to like an old car swap meet kind of car show. And, you know, you had some of the old
the old muscle cars from the, you know, the 60s and 70s, you know, some of the GTOs, some of the Chevelles, you know, some of those really sweet cars. And, you know, he's like, you know, who are using, you know, real gas, the leaded stuff, the, you know, the stuff that not quite the way it was back then, but, you know, lots of exhaust fumes, lots of taste, if you will. And I remember my kid going, just, you know, oh man, that tastes terrible. And, you know, it was one of those things where you go, yeah, because that's how it was. Now imagine sitting in traffic bumper to bumper, you know, for as far as the eye can see, surrounded by that stuff. And oh, by the way, air conditioning wasn't something you used. The windows were wide open, so you were sucking the fumes of the car in front of you and beside you, and you were eating that stuff. And, you know, I remember telling the kids about, you know, going to Lake Erie. And you couldn't go swimming in it because it was so badly polluted, but you did see a lot of fish who were, you know, looking up at the sky with one eye because they were floating dead. And it's one of those things, you know, as a small kid, I remember, you know, it's one of those, you know, I know we use the T word a lot, trauma, but it's one of those vivid memories I have as a kid, you know, seeing this fish frozen in the shoreline, you know, just looking upward. And So I guess the question, and this is where the reason I bring this up is not to regale you with tales of terror from the past, but because, you know, is this where we want to return? You know, we took lead out of gasoline. We got rid of acid rain. The smog levels came down because we said, hey, those smokestacks that are spewing into the air, maybe we should do something about. Hey, corporate America, maybe don't be spewing all of your stuff into the river that's caught on fire numerous times. Maybe don't do that. And look, Cleveland is, you know, and I say, look, my hometown of Cleveland gets a bad rap. Like it was the only place on earth that was that badly polluted. No, it's just the one that the spark happened at the right time and ignited. Could have happened in a lot of places. And actually did happen, just not to the extent. So you go back to the question being, is this where we want to return? To where there wasn't a cop on the beat? To where there wasn't someone saying, no, don't do that. And if you do, there'll be a penalty. Don't take all of your hazardous waste and just dump it in a field somewhere because it's going to get into the water table. And that's bad for us, you and me. Might be cheaper for the corporation, might be better for the bottom line, might make the CEO and the shareholders happy, but the people who have to live around that plant, not so much. And as Marie brought up, you know, it's going to be the most vulnerable communities first. I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland, a minority in a minority community. It was bad. They are going to be the people who suffer first. But that air didn't just stay right there. The bad policy wasn't just there. And this is where I come back to, we've lived through bad things. We've lived through chaos. We've lived through corporate America getting away with literally murder. And we fixed it. Through policy, through smart policy, through, and again, you know, back to this suffering and solution model. There was suffering, there was pain, there was chaos, there was something wrong. And out of that came the solutions to move us forward. Now what we're hearing again is, well, we can't do any of that because those onerous job-killing regulations. A lesson we're going to have to relearn, sadly. We're going to have to remember, I guess, why all of that stuff was put into place in the first place. I know, job-killing regulation, but what about the people-killing lack of? Maybe, sadly, going to have to learn that once again. Want to hear your thoughts. Do you remember the good old days? Sucking leaded gasoline fumes out of the tailpipe, the dual tailpipes. Remember that? Oh, yeah. I want to hear it. Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Miss any portion of the program? Grab the podcast, freespeech.org for the video. And as always, thanks for being here. See you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. At Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
This is 540 WAUK Jackson, Milwaukee's real news and great conversation. A Civic Media station.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Matt Piper. Hamas released four bodies, which Israeli officials said included two young children who have been long feared dead. Their mother was said to be one of them, but hours later, Israeli forces said that another person's remains were released instead. They say those remains are not of any hostage. Our Deborah Pata is in East Jerusalem.
Under a grim Gaza sky, four coffins were paraded in a Hamas propaganda spectacle. The fighters handed over the bodies of four-year-old Ariel Bibas and his nine-month-old brother Kafir. Israel says their mother Shiri was not among them. The family has become an indelible symbol of the October 7 terror attack.
In Washington,
the yeas are 51. The nays are 49.
With that close vote, Kash Patel is the new FBI director. All Democrats voted no as the